Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to talk today about video games, virtual reality, and the boundaries of the self. It's a big issue these days because with millions and millions of Americans deeply involved in the gaming process, that is video gaming, we're beginning to learn a whole lot about what's out there and the kind of impact it has in human lives. And, there's just a whole lot going on that many Americans have no clue about. You know, we're kind of separated right now between those who are intensely into these games and those who really know very little about them. But because it is such a large and influential cultural phenomenon, we're going to take a look at it. Christine Rosen has written an incredible article entitled The Playgrounds of the Self. That's going to be kind of the launching pad. I wrote my commentary on the issue this morning, a blog this afternoon, and we've got lots to talk about. But first, a review of what's in the news. We've been following the controversy over this NARAL ad. That's the NARAL Pro-Choice America ad against Supreme Court nominee John Roberts. It's an atrocity, and one of the most, satisfying realizations over the last 24 hours for me is that at least there is a sufficient number of decent-minded Americans out there who are willing to say that it is an atrocity. And, intellectual integrity demands that we have a respect for the truth. And that means regardless of the side we take in a controversy, on principle and on truth, we need to respect those on the other side who are honest. And so I have to appreciate the fact that someone like Walter Dellinger, who I quoted yesterday, said this is just an atrocity. This is a broadside slander. It's guilt by association. It's just not true. And he said it would be shameful if only those on the pro-life side were clarifying this. And so there was a moment of courage. The Washington Post, there's no doubt that paper is solidly pro-abortion in terms of its editorial policies, but they condemn the ad. Now NARAL has decided to pull the ad, but I want you to hear the statement they made in pulling it. NARAL President Nancy Keenan, after defending the opposition to Roberts, said, and I quote, this to us is Sandra Day O'Connor's seat, and this is the swing seat, particularly on our issue of choice and women's freedom. She went on to say, we regret that many people have misconstrued our recent advertisement about Mr. Roberts' record. You know, the way we phrase public statements betrays who we really are in terms of moral character and all the rest. You know, when we do something wrong, it's insufficient to say mistakes were made. There's just a world of moral distinction between I was wrong and mistakes were made. And there's a world of moral difference between saying we ran a bad ad and we learned the lesson the hard way and we pulled it, and we regret that many people have misconstrued our recent advertisement. I don't think they misconstrued it at all. In fact, to throw her word back at her, the reality is they're in trouble because people construed the ad to mean exactly what they said. Well, we'll be following this closely. Of course, this is going to heat up in coming weeks as the confirmation hearings approach. But in the meantime, let's tell the truth and let's hold others to the truth and let's watch how this thing develops. I received an invitation letter from Nadine Strossen. It's like one of these many pieces of mail that comes to each of our homes. We don't know how we got on a mailing list, but somehow, some way, someone decided to send us a letter. It's a form letter, but I'm going to have a little fun with it. Nadine Strossen is the president of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, and she wants me to be a member. She says, there is no higher calling, no greater reward that democracy can offer an individual than the opportunity to stand up for fundamental freedoms in trying times. Well, I'm with her that far. She says, that's why I hope you will accept my invitation to become the newest card-carrying member of the American Civil Liberties Union. Well, I hope at their headquarters they're not holding their breath on this one. She goes on to say, these are trying times for civil liberties. I'm skipping to the third page of the letter. She says, with the election behind them, administration officials also can be expected to push aggressively a social agenda fueled by the president's personal religious beliefs. From abortion rights to same-sex marriage to government-funded religion, they'll continue their efforts to turn America into a country that dictates its citizens' moral choices. Now, hold on just a minute. Every civilized nation dictates some of its citizens' moral choices. We don't say to our citizens, some of you believe murder is legal and moral. Some of you believe that that murder is immoral. You choose your own way. We won't dictate your moral choice. We dictate our citizens' moral choices about embezzlement, about zoning laws, for that matter, about just about, well, anything, except where there is supposedly this zone of privacy, and that's exactly what is the cherished ground of the American Civil Liberties Union, what the judicial activists have invented over the last 30 years or so. Notice, though, her language, though. She says, this is driven by the president's personal religious beliefs. Now, did he elect himself? Did I miss something? Did he just show up in the Oval Office and say, this office is mine? No, it seems to me that he was elected by millions of Americans. It's their beliefs that elected the president. She goes on and says, through their global gag rule and their federal abortion ban, they'll try to diminish the rights of women to control their most personal decisions, with the ultimate goal being the overturning of Roe v. Wade. The ACLU, she says, will take them on, forcefully defending reproductive rights in every available forum. And we know we can win, as we did earlier this year when a federal trial court struck down the first ever federal abortion ban because it fails to provide an exception to protect women's health. She goes on and she says, in the wake of the election, the forces of the extreme religious right feel emboldened and empowered and will no doubt expand their grassroots efforts to institutionalize discrimination against same-sex couples, to put government-sponsored prayer in our public schools, to limit access to abortion wherever and whenever possible, and to impose their own religious beliefs on all aspects of our community life. Now, notice again the kind of language that's used here. She says that that conservatives, blaming the administration, but of course the conservatives behind them, will try, quote, to institutionalize discrimination against same-sex couples. What is she talking about? Well, right now, where is same-sex marriage legal? In Massachusetts. There may be other forms of something pseudo-marriage, such as civil unions in Vermont and elsewhere. But what she's talking about here are efforts by conservatives to define marriage as the union of a man and a woman. She says that will, quote, institutionalize discrimination against same-sex couples. You know, it's entirely in how you frame the issue, isn't it? Well, I'm not sending in my membership form, and I'm not going to be carrying the membership card, and she wasted some postage and paper sending it to me, but it did give me something to talk about, because you look in your mail, and every once in a while, the culture war arrives in a white envelope. The culture war plays out in some fairly ridiculous forms as well. I'm sure you're following the controversy over the NCAA's ban on Indian mascots and nicknames. And I, for one, as a native of Florida, am proud to see that Florida Governor Jeb Bush is pushing back a bit on this. The Florida State University Seminoles have had that name for many years, and they have done so with the encouragement, the official encouragement of the Seminole tribe of the state of Florida. That's not good enough for the NCAA. This bought into this postmodern idea that any use of any ethnic or other identity like this, any nickname or mascot, is somehow demeaning to the indigenous peoples. They're not even sure what to call them. Is it Native American? Well, that's a problem, because American being a part of that compound means they're defined by being American, even if they're Native, so they're indigenous. But let me ask you the question, isn't everyone indigenous somewhere? But forget that just for a moment. What in the world are you going to do if you're the president of Florida State University? Well, Miles Brand is pushing back as well. Well, we'll see what he's going to do here. Miles Brand with the NCAA, he thinks they have the high ground here. He and his staff are pressing the case, but Florida State says they're going to push back, and so does the governor. We have the Seminole tribe and Governor Bush on our side. How can we go wrong, said Florida State University Vice President Lee Hinkle. But the amazing thing here is that the NCAA is telling the Seminole tribe in Florida that they don't know when they're being oppressed. And, you know, this goes right back to the ideology of Marxism. Follow me. Follow with me here for just a moment. When the Marxists began developing their explanation for why the people seem not to be buying Marxism, they explained it by the Marxist concept of false consciousness. The people just don't know they're being oppressed. That's the same basic approach that Thomas Frank is taking in his new book that's getting a lot of attention, What's Wrong with Kansas, in which he says the people of Kansas are voting conservative. It's just because they don't know they're being oppressed. You see, this false consciousness, they're simply not smart enough to know their own best interest. And that's exactly the kind of false consciousness now that the NCAA is alleging against Florida State University. Well, here's the deal. I can't see the NCAA winning on this one, because they may be able to put some sanctions against a team, but at the end of the day, it's going to be pretty hard to control all those fans, especially if they have the encouragement of the tribe. We're living in strange days. False consciousness abounds. Well, at least that's what the left would have us to think. People simply don't know what's in their own best interest. The NCAA is just one example of what's going on when this kind of thinking poses as morality. It's a pseudo-morality. It's not the real thing. It's not what's really about right and what's true and what's just. It's about what's politically correct. And you know, the more energy that is expended in these pseudo-debates about pseudo-morality, the more conveniently we can forget what's really important. But that's what we're here to talk about today. What's really important? We're going to talk about the challenge of video games and virtual reality on today's Albert Mueller program, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller program. Millions and millions of Americans are playing video games, and they're playing video games many hours of the day. Right now, we're told the average age of a gamer is about 30. Most gamers are age 40 and under, and they're playing games a lot. You're talking about the average adult woman gamer playing 7.4 hours per week, the average adult man gamer playing 7.6 hours per week, and the under 18s playing up to 10 and 12 hours a day, depending on how much access they have to the games and how much parental control is in place and all the rest. But, you know, there's so many issues that are intertwined here. There's some who say this is just the latest form of entertainment. You know, we've always, as human beings, had games. We've invented games. We love to play games. There's something about the competitive nature, the imagination, and all the rest with human beings at play. So good so far. But what is there about video games that makes them different? Here are a couple of suggestions. Number one, a lot of these games involve invented realities and invented identities. And, you know, there's a real moral issue here because some of these people are beginning to wake up and say, you know, while I'm deeply involved in that game, I begin to take on this other person's identity. Do you know that a significant percentage of those who are playing with these invented identities switch genders? In terms of self-reporting from those who are intensely involved in these things, about 15% actually habitually switch genders. They may be a man, but they play a woman who plays a man, a boy who plays a girl who plays a boy. Now, just how healthy is that? There are people who have multiple online identities. They're so deeply involved in these games. Christine Rosen of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, in her new and important article entitled Playgrounds of the Self, published in the latest edition of the New Atlantis, suggests that they may even be forgetting who they are. Now, as Christians, we ought to have a different kind of concern about this. It's not just a matter of a psychological or sociological concern. It's a matter of Christian concern. How should we as Christians think through this? Now, I'm not suggesting that video games are just in and of themselves some kind of evil. I am suggesting that we as Christians need to engage the issue very carefully, and we need to come up with a rubric, a framework for Christian thinking about how we would involve ourselves with these games, how we would allow our children to be involved with these games. In the column that I published this morning, I related an incident. Just a couple of years ago, I was in conversation with a significant number of college students, and informally, after I had spoken, I was talking with this group. They were mostly guys. And I asked them about, you know, what are the biggest temptations you guys face? And technological issues came up. Of course, internet pornography is a big issue, a big challenge for young men in this society. But I was surprised how many of them identified video gaming as their greatest challenge. Now, I'm also an educator, and I have to tell you that it's a challenge when I look at our own student body, when I look at college students today. And I know that they are tempted to spend many hours on the video game when there are other things they should be doing. There are issues here of addiction. Did you know that a lot of the mental activity, the hormonal activity involved in intensive gaming is similar to that which is found in sexual arousal and in panic? The release of those endorphins can be very addictive. All you have to do is look at an adolescent gamer as he's playing the game, and you'll know that you stand very little chance of getting between his consciousness and that screen. He is locked on, and that's where he is. David Grossman, a former military analyst, pointed out that many young adolescent boys are effectively sharpshooters. The eye-hand coordination, there are a lot of people who tell that, say, well, that's a benefit. Well, there's no doubt that many of these young guys have incredible eye-hand coordination, but what kind of social skills do they have, and what kind of Christian discipleship do they model? That's a big question. How should we as Christian parents, how should we as Christians think through this issue? I want to know what you think. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. How do we consider How do we evaluate the challenge of video games? Now, we have talked about this issue before, but in an entirely different light. We've really talked about the content of the games. We've talked about the kind of sexual content and violence that is found in many of these video games. And we did a program just before Christmas, for instance, trying to help parents think through what kind of games might be appropriate. Well, we're kind of taking a larger look today. We're zeroing out here in order to say, where should we really draw the line in terms of how many hours are appropriate, how much access to these games would be appropriate, and what kind of games, before you ever get to the specific content, are games that involve virtual realities and alternative artificial identities, are they really appropriate? Again, the phone number is 877-893-8255. This touches virtually every family, every church, every school. This is an issue that is pretty hot right now in the media as well. The current cover story in The Economist of London is Breeding Evil? The Real Impact of Video Games. Now, The Economist, you won't be surprised, is primarily concerned with the economics of the issue, but they come back and say, look, video games are basically morally neutral. Let me read from the article. They say, so games are inherently good, not bad? Actually, they are neither. Like books, films, the internet, or any other medium, all can be used to depict sex and violence or to educate and inform. Indeed, the inclusion of violent and sexual content in games is arguably a sign of the maturity of the medium as games become more like films. Now, how do you like that for logic? Let me just point out that I really have never seen a discussion group formed around a video game. I've never really seen people come out of a video game or an experience playing a video game and say, you know, that really changed my life, the way an engagement with a significant book or another medium can often do. It seems to me that this is a solitary and sometimes insidiously artificial experience. When you walk in some major stores, especially in the electronics department, you'll see these young adolescent boys primarily. There's some girls there and there's some older people there, but primarily I see preteens and teenage kids, boys, who are playing these games, and you know what? They're not talking to anybody. They're not thinking of anything. They are zeroed in on these games that are there for the demonstration, and they are in their own world. Well, we as parents had better be concerned with what's in that world and what it means. The phone number, 877-893-8255. I want to know what you think about this. There are parents out there. You're facing the decision. How do you set policy? What kind of access do you allow? And there's some of you out there who are no doubt involved in these games. I want to know what you think about it. What's the experience like? How do you evaluate this in your own life? In my weblog today, I cited an article that was published at boundless.org, a very fine site, and it's by a young man who said that he had to unplug himself. He said this, but finding identity in video games carries a cost I didn't understand until just a few months ago. First, it detracts from the identity I am commanded to have in Christ. We are to look to him, the author and finisher of our faith, for our sense of self-worth and purpose. Supplementing with something else is a mistake, especially because extra sources of identity demand time and resources. Apart from Christ, identity is not a gift. It is a return on investment. Put another way, our identity in Christ is derived from what he did on the cross, what he does in our lives, and the future he has promised us. My identity in The Legend of Zelda was derived from the staggering amount of hours I spent figuring out how to get to and defeat dungeon monsters. That's just an excerpt from the article entitled Video Gamers Anonymous, Unplugged from the Matrix. It's by Thomas Griffin IV, and you'll find a link to that at my weblog today. What do you think about this? Invented identities, gender switching in the midst of this identity formation, these giant games with multiple players across the internet. How do you even know with whom you're playing? What about all these hours? Is it truly addictive? Should we be concerned about it? Are we just blowing this up as an issue? Is it just another harmless form of entertainment? Is it morally neutral, as The Economist argues? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I really want to know what you think about this. I'll tell you the truth. I don't know much about video games. I think I could find myself some video games I would like to play, but I'm not sure I'd want to spend the time doing that. Then again, I may just be culturally out of it. You can call and tell me so. 877-893-8255. In the world of real reality, this is the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
All right, welcome back. We're talking about video games, virtual reality, the boundaries of the self, invented identities. How many of you out there are familiar with MMORPGs? That's massive multiplayer online role-playing games. Again, massive multiplayer online role-playing games. Those are the big games played out over the internet involving multiple people with invented personalities. And, you know, that, I would argue, is kind of a stretch from the games that involve, say, football, that are just played on someone's PS2 or Xbox or whatever, or driving. I got a 13-year-old son. He's a part of the video generation, but we limit him to games that are involved with like driving a car or and those that aren't violent. I mean, some of those are pretty bad too when you start looking at them. I mean, like the racing games and things like that. He's got some football games, but we also limit the time. I think that's a big part of it, limiting the time so that it doesn't take away from other more worthy pursuits and so that it doesn't become a real habitual problem in an individual's life. I want to know where you draw the line, how you're thinking about this. Let's go to Brian, calling from Doylestown, Pennsylvania, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Brian, welcome. All right, we lost Brian. Let's go to David in Lorain, Ohio, listening on WHKW. David, what do you think about all this? We're having some technical difficulties, folks. We will want to hear from you. Give us a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We have Chris in Youngstown, Ohio, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Chris, what do you think?
Is this me?
This is you, Chris. Go right ahead.
All right. I like I was saying before, I don't think many other people could be as experienced in this topic. But if you are talking about the massively multiplayer online games, they could definitely, and I am 100% positive, have a toll on somebody's life. Once you start playing stuff like that, people invent a different life for themselves inside a video game.
Now, Chris, you say you're experienced. Have you experienced your own kind of conflict about playing these games or your own involvement in them?
Definitely.
Well, talk to us about that.
I'd have to say the first, now I'm talking about the online games. I probably first started, I think it was eighth grade to my freshman year in high school. And it was a role-playing game is what it was, about dungeons and yada, yada, yada. Anyway, you play for so long, and eventually, I mean, I was playing for about 8 hours a day. And eventually, I kind of pictured myself as my character. I mean, my friends were online. They were whoever I met in the game. And if my character died or I lost something, it made me feel, like, depressed as a person.
Chris, I really appreciate your call. I think Chris's call helps us to personalize this, talking to someone who was involved in it, heavily involved in it, and said, look, you know, if I don't want to put words in Chris's mouth, but it sure sounds to me like he was saying he found some difficulty separating real life from the kind of virtual life involved in the games. If you're depressed in real life about what you lost in virtual life, you got some unfortunate bleed over there. And I think some of this confusion can be really, really dangerous. Christine Rosen cites Howard Rheingold, who wrote the book The Virtual Community. He said this: what kind of multiple distributed system do I become when I live part of the day as a teenage girl in a chat room, part of the day as a serious professional in a web conference, part of the day slaying enemies as Zaxxon, the steel-eyed assassin of an online gaming tribe? You know, this is a really dangerous reality, I would suggest, when you start inventing multiple selves and living that way. We had a caller earlier who was talking about books. And he said, look, when as a young boy I read books, I started to identify with those characters and imagine myself as those characters. And, you know, that is the power of great literature. Let me just say that right up front. Inventing this in terms of thinking along these lines of a character, imagining oneself in this circumstance, that's entirely appropriate. It's when you begin to construct your own dialogue and you begin to relate to others who are also in invented identities and you begin to confuse reality with virtual reality, I think that's the problem. You know, the reality is that you can't hook up a book in one of these multiple massive online role-playing games. But that's what you find on the internet, and there are hundreds, thousands, and indeed millions of our fellow citizens deeply involved in these games. For others, it's just the Xbox, the PS2, Nintendo, or whatever, and the amount of time spent. We as parents have to think these things through, and so does every Christian. I admit right up front, this is somewhat a generational reality. My guess is there aren't a lot of 80-year-olds that are dying to get the latest Nintendo edition in order to play these games. But Bill Gates talks about Generation E, the generation born after 1975. They really don't know anything but an electronic reality. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Well, we're talking about video games, and as usual, there are a lot of people ready to talk about them. That makes sense. Millions of people are playing them, and a lot of others are concerned about them, wondering about them. This is a new day. There are all kinds of technological innovations. Every single one of them arrives with a new set of moral questions. And we certainly don't want to take the route of just being Luddites, like those in previous centuries who said of technology, we just will have nothing of it. We're using the internet right now. I want you to go to the internet, find the website, read the weblog, read the commentaries. We're talking on an advanced digital technology here in terms of how the satellite transmits even this program. We're living in a technological age. You can't just say no, but you really can't just say yes either. You can't just embrace every new technology with every application that it could be used for. We have to think these things through, hopefully, as responsible Christians. Let's go to David calling from Roanoke, Virginia, listening on XM Satellite Radio. David, welcome.
Welcome, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing great, thank you. Go right ahead.
I just want to say God bless you, and I like your program. I think it's one of the top ones on XM. Anyways, the one thing I want to comment on, these kids are paying to do these games and to interact and take on these different characters, right?
Right.
Al, when we were young, when you go to a movie, what do you do? You get a feeling, oh, I could be Arnold Schwarzenegger. When you watch TV, what do women do with desperate housewives every week? How can we ask our kids to be any different than us if all we do is look and watch TV? Aren't we the ones that are supposed to lead by example? They're doing $50 at a time, and they don't have to watch it through a TV. They can put the game thing on and be that person. Well, aren't we doing the same thing? By watching TV, aren't we looking at, what's the show with Joe on it, the one where they have people eating animal parts and like that?
Well, David, hold on a minute. Let me just ask you, though, don't you think there's a distinction? I mean, certainly the idea of trying on different characters and all the rest, that's been a part of literature since the ancients. Even before you get to television or anything like that, just with books or, for that matter, just narrative storytelling. But don't you think it's different when you take on these elongated artificial identities and you play them out interacting with other people across the internet?
Isn't that your imagination, though, Al?
Well, I'd say it's a good deal more than imagination, David, when people are spending hours and hours investing their lives and they're having a hard time knowing the difference between the real. And I've had very few people who walked out of a movie theater thinking they're Arnold Schwarzenegger. I've had very few people that have come out of reading a book who have said, I think I'm Tom Swift. I think that's the line I'm really concerned about. Appreciate your calls. Good to hear from you. Let's go to Brian in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, listening on XM. Brian, glad to hear from you.
Thank you, Dr. Mueller. Great caller. Great last caller. I want to just comment, I guess, on top of that is this alternative reality that we talk about with video games, it's no different than the alternative reality that most people live in our country and around the world. We're living in an alternative reality if we sell ourselves short of what the truth is. And I think what's happened and what your caller remarked on was that whether it's, a woman watching Desperate Housewives or a man watching Joe Millionaire, they're participating in imagining themselves as some other character. Now, video games, you're right. It is a different medium, much different than TV, much different than a book. And the medium, The Economist was wrong. The medium is the message. The medium is not amoral. There are certain mediums that encourage certain behaviors and other mediums that don't encourage certain behaviors. So, yes, you're right. The medium is the message, as Ken Myers has said in many more words.
Hey, Brian, hang with me here for just a minute. Let me ask you something. I appreciate your call and also David's call dealing with this, because you're speaking in terms of the fact that an alternative reality is very seductive to any of us. And I understand that. And in fact, there are people who just can't handle reality, won't face reality. And I have to take it one step further and say the only way to know the real reality is to know it through Jesus Christ, the Logos of the universe. But, a part of what I'm concerned about is, I guess I have to broaden it and say, I think the point that that you and David have both made about a show like Desperate Housewives or something else, it reminds us that we can't just start with video games. We have to talk about how we engage any kind of medium. And, quite frankly, I'm very concerned about anyone who would watch those programs, I guess it just shows us again the complexities of living in this age and how we have to be watchful about everything. Just understand, I'm not giving a pass to television, not by a long shot. Brian, let me ask you: do you play these games, or how do you make your own decisions about this?
Yeah, I have a video game system and have probably about 90 games, and I spend less than probably an hour or two a month on video games. But I do have them at my access and disposal. I'm in my, I'm 24 years old and I play, less than an hour or two a month. So, I think, but I would go further. I would say that it's not just the medium. It's not just TV and books and video games, but the alternative reality is what many people are living when their worldview isn't consistent with reality. So, even within our own churches, even within my own life, I'm seeing an alternative reality.
Yet,
what is in my heart?
Yeah, Brian, I'm so sorry we lost your signal there. You were making a very significant point. Unfortunately, your cell signal didn't appreciate the point you were making. But I hope you'll call us back again and continue that thought one day and keep listening. I this is a fascinating conversation. I have to tell you, I'm learning along with the rest of you out there. I'm thankful, really, that there are some thoughtful people who are trying to think this through. Let me go to Craig calling from Louisville, Kentucky, on WFIA. Go ahead, Craig.
Yeah, Dr. Mueller, I got into a guild when I was playing these games. I played for about 3 or 4 years, and I was playing one of the real popular games. I won't mention the name of it, but the people in that guild, they got to know each other. We would type to each other, talk, and they'd end up talking on the phone. It got to the point where people were divorcing each other and marrying other people in the guild in real life. And what got me out of the game was when somebody walked up to me, your character had to have a deity. And they said, well, what god do you worship? And I thought about that. I thought, well, this is wrong. I know the god I worship, and this is not it. So.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that point very much. As a matter of fact, Craig, Christine Rosen, in the article I cite in my commentary today, she points to a statement by Jonathan Dee in the New York Times Magazine in which he's talking about Christian gamers. There are Christian games out there and a debate. And one of the people involved in this said, look, here's the reality. The Christian gamer's position is that while you may fight the devil and lose, you may not fight as the devil. Well, that's an interesting point. We're living in a new age when people can even conceive of such a thing, organize it, play it, merchandise it, and sell it. I'll be back with some final thoughts. We've obviously hit a nerve with this one, and we're going to have to think about this one some more. We'll think together. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Folks, that was a fascinating exchange. I really appreciated the callers today. And let me tell you, they were lined up. What we needed was air traffic control as much as a call receiving process here. There was no time to get everyone on the air, but this conversation is going to continue. We'll pick this up again in a program in the near future. And in the meantime, let me know what you think. If you know something I ought to be reading on this, if you see something I ought to be thinking about this, then send it to me. Write me at albertmohler.com. That's Albert, MOHLER.com. If you agree or if you disagree, whatever point you want to make, you email us and it'll get to me. You start looking at these questions and you realize our engagement with the media is a huge issue. And we are engaging different aspects and dimensions of the mass media all the time. If it's not video games, if it's not the internet, then it's television or radio, or it's the media in terms of the news and the newspaper and all the rest. It's the entertainment industry, Hollywood and film and movies and all the paraphernalia. You start looking at how large all this amounts to in terms of a sector of our economy and a sector of our time, and you begin to realize one of the most crucial issues of our Christian discipleship just has to be how we make our decisions engaging the mass media. Now, I think what we need to avoid here very clearly is a legalism that says here is a set of rules you can always follow, and on the other hand, an antinomianism that says there are no rules. What we need is mature Christian engagement. There ought to be some rules. Every family had better have some rules. Parents, you better be setting down some boundaries. But we also need to help each other as Christians think through these particular issues. When we watch a movie together, do we evaluate whether it told the truth, whether it told the truth beautifully, whether it told the truth in a way that avoided the kind of propaganda techniques and mind control and manipulation to which the mass media can be very much given? How do we make decisions about what movie we're going to rent, what movie we're going to see, what book we're going to read? And yes, books are a part of that too. There are people who say, I don't have any engagement with all this mass media. Well, Do you read the back of a product announcement? Do you read the label on a can of soup? You're reading something. You're engaging the larger world. There's no way to get out of this, folks. We are like Aristotle's fish swimming in the sea. We can grow so accustomed to being wet we don't even realize the water we're swimming in. We need to be, as Christians, mature and strategic thinkers. And let's remember that not one of us, none of us, is wise enough to think this through alone. We need to think it through as Christians together. We'll join you again next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation, live from Louisville, Kentucky. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.